My name is Cameron Munter. I'm the CEO and president of the East West Institute in New York, and I welcome you to this EWI podcast, where we take the opportunity to explore some of today's global issues with leading thinkers, influencers, and analysts. And we have one of these leading thinkers, influencers, and analysts here with us this morning. Suzanne DiMaggio is with us from the New America Foundation, someone I've known and admired for a long time. She works on issues of terrorism, regional security, and nonproliferation, has done so for many years. For the specific purpose of our talk today, Suzanne directs the U.S.-Iran Initiative at New America. She also is directing U.S.-North Korea dialogue that has included many visits to North Korea, and about which she has written recently in the press, and we'll get back to that in just a minute as well. As part of this process, she facilitated the first official discussions of the Trump administration and the North Korean government in Oslo earlier this year in May. Suzanne, welcome. And we'll be talking not only about North Korea, but we'll also be talking about diplomacy in general, including lessons that have been learned from Iran and your experience there, to see if that's applicable. So let's begin perhaps by having you tell us, what do you think in this particular case North Korea wants with a nuclear program, and how do you formulate the question?
Well, first let me say thank you, Cameron, for hosting me today. I'm thrilled to be here at the new offices of the East West Institute. So what do the North Koreans want? That's a very good question. I think I'll just work from my own discussions with them that have been taking place fairly regularly over the past 2 years. Mm-hmm. And they track well with what they also say publicly. First of all, their motivation for their nuclear program, especially at this very accelerated pace that we've been seeing. 22 nuclear tests last year, 20 missile tests, and then of course this year in July we saw 2 ICBM tests, and then in September, a hydrogen bomb detonation. So they're clearly making progress.
And this is a sharp increase on previous years, correct?
Absolutely. So mm-hmm. Under Kim Jong-un, we are seeing a much more accelerated pace. And the reason is clear. They say that they fear regime change by the hands of the United States, and they have determined that the only way they could stop us from doing that is to have a nuclear deterrent. So that's their motivation. Beyond that, some people think that they also are looking ahead to the future and the possibility of trying to reunify the peninsula under their terms. That's something I think we don't know for sure. It's a theory, but it's something we should explore.
Well, that's an interesting problem, trying to see it from the North Korean point of view, which you're uniquely suited to do. You think of the philosophy, and tell me how it's pronounced, Yuche or
Yuche,
Yuche, which is something that the family has propagated for decades. And, you know, one tends to think or to hear in the United States press that this is a kind of a group of people who are simply trying to stay in power. But you hint that they maybe have a mission, reunification of Korea on North Korean terms. Is there anything else that we need to know that you've gotten from the North Koreans that makes it less of a one-dimensional understanding?
Yes, I think we also need to think about their short-term and longer-term intentions. Mm-hmm. The longer-term we just discussed as one possibility. Mm-hmm. In the short-term, their clear goal right now is to demonstrate to the world that they have a reliable capability to launch a ICBM, nuclear-tipped ICBM that could hit U.S. soil. Mm-hmm. Based on their most recent testing, they're on their way to getting that. They already have the capability to hit Seoul and Tokyo, so they already have a deterrent. But I think going that extra mile and being able to demonstrate that they could perhaps not only hit Anchorage, but maybe even Seattle and Los Angeles is well within their sights.
I mean, we came close to hostilities years ago, I guess 1994 is an example. You know, and President Trump does refer back to what he calls failed attempts to try to deal with the problem. How do you see the history of the last years defining the way both the North Koreans and the Americans see the problem, and people in the region?
Well, it's commonly accepted now that past diplomatic efforts didn't work, but I disagree with that interpretation. Mm-hmm. A more careful reading of the record shows that for nearly 9 years, During the framework agreement, the North Koreans did not develop their missile capability. Diplomacy did work. What I like to say is diplomacy worked. It was the implementation that failed, faulty implementation. And there's fault on both sides. Certainly the North Koreans cheated. Certainly we didn't move fast enough on providing things we said we would, like peaceful nuclear reactors for energy. And also, we should keep in mind that the agreement itself, the 1994 framework agreement, was a four-page agreement for such a intensely complicated subject matter. Compare that to the JCPOA, the Iran Nuclear Agreement, which stands at over 160 pages. When the North Koreans were caught cheating, if that happened today with the Iranians, there is a process in place, a joint commission, that would meet immediately, review it, and see how to get it back on track. We wouldn't just throw the agreement out, although some in Washington would like us to do that. And we need, if we're going to reach another agreement with the North Koreans, we need to learn from recent experience how to make these agreements better. And I think that's one element of the Iran agreement we should learn.
What you're implying is that one of the ways to look at this is not simply as a U.S. North Korean relationship, but if we use the parallel or the analogy of the Iran relationship, the Iran agreement, that it's the multilateral element of that that makes the enforcement perhaps potentially more effective. And you mentioned that there were faults on both sides in the past, that other agreements haven't been held, but they were primarily bilateral, as I recall.
And yes.
Would you argue that that we might be wise to think multilaterally of any kind of about any kind of agreement in North Korea?
Yes, I think I absolutely agree with you, Karen. But in the immediate period, the North Koreans have made it clear to us that they're only interested in talking to the United States. So they see this as a bilateral dialogue that has to happen first before it moves to a multilateral framework.
Why is that? Why do they just want to talk with the Americans?
Well, it's a number of reasons. One is, technically, we're still at war with them. Mm-hmm. Don't forget, we have an armistice, ceasefire agreement. We don't have a peace treaty, and that's something that they really want. Secondly, it's a prestige issue. So to be negotiating shoulder to shoulder with the United States, in their mind, it puts them on equal footing. So that's what I mean by prestige. Mm-hmm. And also, the North Koreans have said that the six-party talk framework is no longer viable. So even if we get through a bilateral discussion and move to the multilateral, we may need to think about how to reconfigure the multilateral aspect of this. Of course, the major players are there, and they have to remain. But what else are the North Koreans looking for? Who else do they want to include? Or do they want to just keep it maybe U.S., North Korea, and South Korea? That's another question we have to ask them.
Well, the president has just been in Japan and just been in Korea and in China. What do you make of that trip, what you've seen of the trip, in the context of these questions about whether there's a multilateral or at least common cause that can be made by people in the region, especially in light of the often repeated phrases from the president that this is China's problem as much as anyone else, that exhortation to China to act. Did the trip change any of that or paint it more clearly?
Well, as one colleague put it to me, it could have been a lot worse.
Okay, that's good to know.
Or another way of looking is it could have been a lot better.
Sure.
So certainly in Seoul, he toned the rhetoric down. Although in front of the National Assembly, he was very harsh towards Kim Jong-un, but it wasn't a personal attack.
Would you draw a distinction between prepared remarks in front of the Assembly and then perhaps off-the-cuff remarks, which were different?
Yes. So the prepared remarks in the assembly, he obviously stuck to the script. And he did leave an opening for diplomacy, although it wasn't clear to me whether or not denuclearization was still a precondition or something to work on in the future. I think that needed to be clarified better, because if it is a precondition, obviously that's a non-starter. His off-the-cuff remarks, I think, he also showed some restraint. The problem is, nowhere in his remarks so far in both Seoul and Beijing, and also Tokyo, did he actually talk about the path forward. What exactly is the strategy to get there? And maybe he would, knowing who he is, we wouldn't expect him to go into such detail, but to not even elaborate on what that path might look like, I think left a lot of people thinking, maybe there isn't a path. And also the contradictory statements that you pointed out. My fear is that that could lead to misinterpretation on the part of the North Koreans. I think a lot of the rhetoric he's put forward has led some of them to believe that military action is the preferred course. And if that's the case, I think that's a problem. We need to be clear. If it's not the case, it's also a problem. So that could lead to a miscalculation, especially when all of this rhetoric is happening against the backdrop of a big movement of strategic assets, military assets into the region. We now have three carrier groups in the Pacific waters. That's certainly not unprecedented, but it's very rare. We have overflights of B-1B bombers, and that is also sending a signal to the North Koreans that perhaps some sort of military action is imminent. That could be part of the U.S. strategy, but you can see how through misinterpretation it could spiral into something that we could lose control over very quickly.
Well, you're one of the few people who's actually done that. What are some of the insights you've gotten from dealing with the North Koreans personally? I mean, I would argue that North Korea in much of the press in the United States is a bit of a caricature, that we have this notion of kind of comic book character leaders in a country that is portrayed as being any number of strange things. What's the sense that you would give to listeners about dealing with North Koreans and how your personal ties have made a difference?
Well, I think what's important, especially with the sort of work I do in the Track 2 realm, is to convene dialogue on a fairly regular basis if it's possible. That isn't always possible with the North Koreans. It takes a lot of persistence. But I think the more sustained over time, the better. Also, meeting with the same interlocutors over time is helpful. You build a relationship of familiarity, which is always a good thing. But I have to say, in my experience, you know, speaking and interacting with the North Koreans is very unique, especially when you're doing it in Pyongyang. It is a very isolated place.
So when you say unique, it's not like talking to the Iranians. It's not like talking to the Russians or someone else.
Exactly.
And they do act differently.
Yes, they do. They have a different worldview. I mean, the isolation is very clear. One of the reasons I like to speak to them in Pyongyang is to speak to them from where they sit on a daily basis and get a sense of what their worldview is. And their threat perception is quite high. And when you're there and speaking to them, you actually feel it. You get a sense of what their world might look like. I think that's very important. And that's something U.S. negotiators and diplomats have not been able to do all these years, very sporadically, is actually go there and speak to them in their own place.
Well, we talked a little bit about, you know, Iran as an example. And on the one hand, you've emphasized that it is kind of a unique situation, that it's fair to say that the view from Pyongyang is more isolated and more eccentric, perhaps, than the view from Tehran. But where might similarities come in, and where might the lessons learned from, especially that you learned from your efforts in the JCPOA and in the work with Iran, where might that be constructive for American and Western leaders to engage?
I think one of the biggest lessons is how to begin engagement with an adversary like Iran and then like North Korea. And there are some similarities there. And that's why I've advocated for talks about talks before negotiations can begin. In the case of Iran, this was conducted secretly.
And when you say talks about talks, What does that really look like?
It means meeting quietly, a little under the radar. In the case of Iran, as I said, secretly, if that can happen. I don't think we could do anything secretly with the North Koreans, but under the radar, let's put it that way. It was an opportunity with the Iranians because there's such a lack of communication between our governments to have more informal talks about what are our country's policies towards each other. If we were to enter into negotiations, what are some of the goals? Where are there areas for compromise? Where are the red lines? And I think if we didn't go through that exercise with the Iranians before opening it up to a multilateral negotiation, we would have never had a final nuclear deal. There's no question in my mind about that. And given the high level of distrust between Pyongyang and Washington, I think we would benefit from a similar model.
And so part of this is doing your homework, just getting to know the unknown elements.
Yes, it's also a good chance to really set the ground rules for going forward and also what is possible. In the case of the Iran talks, U.S. diplomats were able to convey two very important things in those early discussions. One, the U.S. is not after regime change in Iran. And two, they made a significant concession. They addressed one of the Iranians' red lines and said the U.S. would be agreeable to the Iranians having the capability to enrich uranium on their soil. It was a very highly monitored concession, but nonetheless, without this, there would be no deal today. And it was only through those initial talks that we were able to get through.
So what this means is, in addition to the attitude of coming forth and having talks with North Korea, we would have to be prepared to make some concessions. That's what happens when you do the, let's coin a phrase, the art of the deal.
Yes.
Right? And is that if we're going to make concessions, we'd have to be able to think, what can we give that we don't want to give? And might one of those concessions with North Korea be accepting a nuclear North Korea?
I think I find it hard to imagine this administration doing that. Mm-hmm. I think that might be a bridge too far. But I do think we should take a page out of the Iran deal playbook. Right now, we have a situation where two sets of sanctions, the toughest sanctions we've seen against North Korea, were passed at the United Nations, and then the U.S. followed up with the unilateral sanctions. So we have built up some pressure. And like we did with Iran, we should now pivot to engagement and point to an off-ramp. With the Iranians, that's exactly what happened. The U.S. diplomats pointed to an off-ramp and offered a way forward. What that way forward is, I don't think it's accepting the nuclear program, but maybe an agreement where we could live with it for a little while and build some trust, tackle some other issues, and look at it as a long-term objective. I think if we could put it in that context, the North Koreans would consider it.
Well, to finish up then, I mean, maybe what we've come to is that question of looking at what is immediate problem and seeing that it actually is only solvable if we begin to look long term. And the country that traditionally has talked that way, at least, has been China, that looking at the North Korean issue, I mean, I think it's fair to say our Chinese interlocutors are concerned as well. It's not that they're cavalier about this, but there's a tendency for them to look longer term. Is China part of the solution, and that longer term concept? Could China be helpful in this?
So China is absolutely part of the solution, but they are not the solution.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Trump administration lost a lot of time early on focusing on getting China to solve this problem. In Beijing, just recently, Trump said again that China could solve this problem overnight. We have to realize that our interests and China's interests on the North Korean peninsula do not necessarily overlap.
Completely overlap. They
yes,
may overlap somewhat.
They overlap somewhat, but it's not a perfect match. Mm-hmm. I think the Chinese would be perfectly content accepting Pyongyang's nuclear program as long as they didn't get crazy about it. I don't think the Trump administration is quite there yet. But that being said, I think we need to approach Beijing differently. I think we would have a better response from them if we were able to demonstrate that we are trying in good faith to have diplomatic engagement with the North Koreans, I think then they would be more likely to press Pyongyang harder once they saw we were really trying to gain traction on the engagement angle. That's a shift in tone rather than threatening them with breaking trade deals and things like that. And I think it would be worth trying. In fact, I think that's what Tillerson was trying to do when he was in Beijing recently, was trying to convey to the Chinese that the U.S. was going to try to get the talks started. But of course, Trump in those famous tweets of his undercut it completely by saying, Rex, you're wasting your time.
Although it may be that what happened behind closed doors in Beijing over the last day or two, where the president, at least in public, was saying what a great friend Xi is that he may have been trying to make that point. We might find that there is, in fact, a certain press effort to try to gain the trust of the Chinese and to see it from their point of view. Do you think that's possible?
It's possible. Is it likely? That's a different question. I sure hope so. I hope over time and this president is learning about this issue, how complicated it is, how it does require diplomats to carry out this work. He and the president alone cannot do this on his own. I think he still needs to learn a bit more. And he needs to make sure that the United States has the capacity to engage in such intricate, delicate, sensitive diplomacy. That's one thing that worries me right now, is if Pyongyang called Washington tomorrow and said, hey, we're ready to do a very intense diplomatic engagement with you, I'm not sure we have the capacity to pull that off right now.
Right. You know, as a former diplomat, I'm concerned by the reports that I think both of us have heard about the thinning of the ranks at the State Department and the loss of expertise, that even if there were the conceptual clarity that would lead to an effort, I think this is the point you're making, the ability to implement and to work through the details takes an entire team. I think you mentioned that we had an enormous team of people working in Iran from all over the government agencies. That might not be possible right now.
Yes, I mean, with the Iran deal, we really had America's A-team. The best diplomats the United States has were involved. We also had Ernest Moniz, a scientist diplomat, was very much involved, and I think without his input, we may not have gotten a deal at the end. But we also had the technical experts, nuclear experts, and so forth. It was a really full-throated effort, diplomatic effort. And then, let's not forget, we also had ambassadors in key capitals.
Which we don't have now.
Which we don't have now. So, of course, we urgently need, especially, a ambassador in Seoul.
Well, to sum up, what would you say is the road forward? What do you think will happen? You know, Trump's not even finished with his visit now, but what do you see over the next few months? What do you think will happen?
Well, first is to continue the process of de-escalation. He tried to contain himself on this trip so far. I think if he can come back to Washington and continue that, lay off the tweets, lay off the personal insults towards Kim Jong-un, that would clear the air a bit. Then really speak in a clear way about U.S. policy and the promise of diplomacy. And then empower the diplomats to do this. We have a fantastic diplomat, Ambassador Joseph Yun, who oversees North Korea policy at the State Department. Empower him to take the lead. Also consider engaging a presidential envoy on North Korea to work closely with the State Department, but also senior North Korean officials, and begin those talks about talks. In the case of Iran, those happened over months. I think there's more urgency. We need to speed that up and start that immediately.
Well, that's something that I think you, in your role in the past, you've always played a constructive role. Let's hope that wise heads take advantage of that. We at East West also, with our work in the region, are always ready to try to engage in that area. And I think this is one of those diplomatic instances where it goes beyond just the official diplomats, but it goes to the diplomats who are creative like yourself, who are going to be playing a role. And so We'll look to what you're up to. We'll look to what the government says. And I think we'll all have our fingers crossed that those aspects of this visit that we hope come from it, perhaps developing a more coherent attitude and laying off the more incendiary elements.
Yes, will happen. I hope so. Thank you, Cameron. Thank you.
Suzanne, thank you for being with us. And it's really a pleasure to discuss this, and good luck to you.
Thanks so much. It was my pleasure.